Hey, welcome everybody. Representative Linnea, settle down. Welcome everybody. First, I think we're going to do is just have our fiscal analyst Doug Berg give us a little brief overview of just. Did everyone get a sheet of? You've got a printout, members, in your packet, I believe. That looks like this. And so, why don't we just today go over the higher ed portion of it?
Mr. Chairman, members, as the chairman said, there should be in your packet. There's a cover memo with my name on it, and then a second page. This is just a very simple one-page general fund only. Change item summary for accounts within the division. And so it's meant to give you just a very quick snapshot of what is in the governor's general fund budget. That isn't the total of changes. There are some non-general fund changes in some of the accounts, but the bulk of it will show at the change item level on this sheet. And members, you'll get more detail later as I get the all fund spreadsheet together and the narrative summary. Just for today, if you look down the gray column, the middle gray column, FY 10-11, you'll see that for the Office of Higher Education, it's a total reduction of $15 million. That's 3.4% of their budget. The governor did that by protecting the state grant program from cuts, which is the largest amount of their money. Going to Minscu, it's a $146 million cut, 10.7%. The university is a $151 million cut from the base, which is a 10.8% cut. And the Mayo Foundation is a $250,000 cut, which is a 9.4% cut. The others, the non-higher ed accounts are down there as well, and I'll just skip over those for now.
We can go over those next week. So if anyone has any questions, Mr. Berg, did you understand the explanation given by Commissioner Hansen to me yesterday at the Finance Committee meeting as to why they were using different numbers?
Mr. Chairman, members, yes. I mean, there's some other numbers floating around that's been in, I think, the Daily reported and others. There's an 8.2% figure for higher education that it was in the governor's slides and the Finance Department. That figure represents the governor's 10 and 11 recommendations on a percent change from the 8-9 actual after an allotment. So that's governor's recs 10-11 over 8-9. The numbers that I'm showing you here are the governor's recs compared to forecast 10-11, or the base, as we tend to refer to it.
Well, actually, he took the unallotment and took money away from them, then he figured it on.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, it's figured from actual 8-9, not from appropriated 8-9.
And we'd like to welcome the 9th to 12th grade students from the Immaculate Heart of Mary Academy who are up there in the audience. Welcome to the Capitol. Nice to see you. And I had a parochial education, too. And so did my community administrator, and you might turn out like me someday. Welcome.
No comment.
Did you have anything to add, Representative?
I have nothing to add.
Yes. That was, I think he went to school with Pope Leo I. I think that was.
He picked up the number one when I was there, actually.
Welcome to the committee, Chancellor McCormick. Nice to have you.
Thank you.
And staff coming up with you. Trustee Rainier, thank you very much. I had, members, I had asked Mr. Olson to come here, and evidently Mr. Olson was busy, and then I had asked if Mr. Benson would come from the business community, then Mr. Benson was evidently busy, so they brought poor Mr. Rainier here thinking I wouldn't beat up on him because he's from the 8th Congressional District, but they're wrong.
And the product of a parochial education.
Welcome. Yeah. Go ahead, Councilman Farmer, however you're going to do it.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members. I'm Jim McCormick, Chancellor of Minnesota State College University System, and with me today are, as you know, Trustee Tom Rainier, and I might add that Trustee Rainier is the Chairman of the Finance Committee, and Vice Chancellor Chief Financial Officer Laura King, and Ann Winia, the President of North Hennepin Community College, and Richard Davenport, President of the Minnesota State University of Mankato. And in addition to that, I think in our audience, we have President Opat at Normandale and President Johns at Anoka Ramsey and President Ann Lyons at Anoka Tech. I think the three are here something. Welcome. Thank you. You've asked us today to talk about how the system has handled past budget cuts, recessions, and unallotments, and to look ahead and talk about how we would deal with the 10.7% cut that the governor's recommended. And I was here for the 2001-2002-3 challenge, and I would like to ask Trustee Rainier to talk briefly about our overall strategy for dealing with these budget cuts. Trustee Rainier.
Thank you, Chancellor. Chairman Covina, members of the committee. I am Tom Rainier, for the record. I think it's fair to say that we're all very sobered by the size of the state budget deficit. Our presidents are used to making tough decisions, and for the past several months, they've been engaged in planning for a variety of budget scenarios. As a board, I can say that we intend to move thoughtfully and to make sure we have all the information we need to make decisions that will be in the best interest of our students and of the state of Minnesota. As we look toward the next biennium, we intend to follow three key principles as we make decisions. We will make decisions in a way that best serves students. We will take into account how to serve the economic development needs of the state and its communities. And we will take a long-term, multi-year approach, positioning the system for long-term financial viability. We'll be guided by the Board of Trustees' strategic plan, and we will work diligently to find places where we can become more efficient and make better use of current resources. We understand that this is the beginning of a lengthy process. We know you are facing very tough decisions, but we ask that you keep in mind that we stand ready to maintain the integrity of the system and thereby continue to play the critical role we have always played in being part of both the short and long-term solutions to these serious economic challenges. Thank you.
Yes, for the benefit of the several new members, although I had the privilege of meeting with all of you, I'd like to give you just a very brief system overview. We are a diverse system of 32 colleges and universities, committed, deeply committed in all of our core values to the needs of the people of Minnesota. We're the largest provider of higher education in the state, providing access to higher education opportunities on 54 state-owned campuses in 46 Minnesota communities. Although since the creation of the system, we've taken those 54 and organized it into 32 colleges and universities. So we have a number of colleges that might have four or five campuses. We serve 390,000 students each year in credit and non-credit courses. And I'll say a word about it, but I predict that will go up in view of our economic circumstances. Now, our enrollment in the system has been very healthy. We're at record enrollment. We're projecting increases the next 2 years. And traditionally, and I know all of you know this from your communities, but traditionally in times of economic uncertainty, the demand for higher education increases, at least in our system, in particular the two-year colleges, when people seek to learn new skills that can help them obtain a new job or a better job. Now, I know that you have, and we all have, some difficult decisions ahead. But I believe it is important for you to remember, and I think I need to say it, although I know many of you and I know you know this, but to remember that higher education, the University of Minnesota, and the Minnesota State Colleges and Universities is the key to economic recovery. Our colleges and universities are the place where laid-off workers will turn to learn new skills for new jobs, Our colleges and universities offer everything from short-term programs to associate, bachelor's, and graduate degrees. Mr. Chair, I attended our presentation, and I wanted to get back to you on this one, on the Capital Investment Committee last week. And some of you were present, and I heard members have deep concern for a speedy execution of our proposed facilities project. We've gone back to the drawing board. Four of our capital projects, the North Hennepin Community College in Brooklyn Park, Mesabi Range Community and Technical College in Eveleth, Lake Superior College in Duluth, and Metropolitan State University, can be bid in 30 days. That's almost $30 million in construction contracts underway immediately. We sent our proposed $50 million HEPRA list to the chairs, as was requested, earlier this week, and we're currently working with each college and university to confirm their ability to speed up contracts should this funding become available. Last week, we predicted $30 million under contract by December of 2009. As of today...
Can I stop you there?
Yeah.
Because I was a little puzzled by that presentation, and I don't understand how, just for, you know, roofs and other maintenance things that are done at, whether it's at Joe's College or Atkins or wherever, that you, it would take that long to get those projects out the door.
We're moving them faster. It does take engineering in many of those cases. And I tell you, we're pushing to move them, but we've got lots ready. And I just want to tell you that we're pushing, but they still have to be designed. And we're going to be ready. But I want you to know, Chair Riccobina, that today we can improve that to $25 million within 90 days of funding.
Oh, you're getting there.
And a total of $40 million within 6 months. We've moved that up, made it a major priority. And each of our presidents have worked on it, too, this last week. We heard, for the rest of the members here who were not at that meeting, the deep concern that if we were to do something, it needs to be now, and we need to do it fast. So I wanted to be responsive on that. We're also looking closely at the four additional projects that were partially funded in 2008 to see what can be done to advance project design for earlier bidding. And, Mr. Chair, I wanted to bring that revision. I know it doesn't quite fit this committee, but I thought it was important for you to know our commitment to moving that. And what I would like to do now is to turn to Laura King, and several of the presidents, unless there are questions this time, but I do plan to return at the end of the presentation for any questions that might occur then. But Mr. Chair, I'd like to turn it over to Laura, unless you or members have questions at this point.
Why don't we bring Ms. King up, and then we'll bring all of you back. Ms. King, welcome to the committee. Oh, it's a pleasure to see you.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. It's always a pleasure to be here, Mr. Chair. You know that.
Yes,
I'm sure. The Chancellor has asked me... I mean that sincerely.
I know.
The Chancellor has asked me to pick up and continue responding to the questions that the staff sent over. And so today we'll speak to 3 points. A review of the 2003 deficit and how we handled it. The 2009 unallotment and the 2010-2011 budget recommendations and how we would approach handling the cut that's been recommended. First, on the 2003 deficit, to understand what happened in 2003, I need to back up and provide a little context. In June of 2002, the legislature approved a budget for the 2002-2003 biennium that reduced the system's appropriation for the second year of the biennium by $22.6 million. The system's appropriation was further reduced by $25 million in early 2003 through an allotment by Governor Pawlenty. The result of these actions was that the system was cut $47.6 million, or 7.4%, in fiscal 2003. By January of 2003, or midway through fiscal 2004, the situation had worsened. And by the end of that legislative session, our budget for the 2004-2005 biennium was cut by 14.8%, or $191 million, from the 2003 base budget. So, in all, the system lost $239 million from the beginning in 2003. At the same time, demand for our educational services was increasing. From 2002 to 2005, at the time we were being cut by nearly $240 million, our full-year equivalent enrollment grew from 126,000 FYE to 135,000, an increase of more than 9,000 full-time equivalent students, or about 7%. This is approximately equal to two-thirds of the enrollment at St. Cloud State University. How did we handle that? Mostly we increased tuition. Starting in fiscal two, we had four consecutive years of double-digit tuition increases. This had the effect of shifting a large portion of responsibility for higher education from the state to our students. In 2002, the state appropriation paid for 66% of the cost of education, while tuition paid for 34%. By 2005, the state share had dropped to 52%, while the student share had risen to 48%. Since then, that shift has continued. This year, the state share will be 50%, barely higher than the student share of 49%. Even with the tuition increases, total spending was not enough to cover increased costs. The colleges and universities had to reallocate and make cuts to balance their budgets, similar to what they're doing now to handle the 2009 unallotment. I would like to make one more point in regard to the 2003 budget cuts. Back then, our base appropriation was automatically adjusted to reflect enrollment increases or decreases. That provision was removed from statute in 2006, and since then, our appropriation has not been connected to our enrollment levels. So as the number of students we serve goes up, the last couple of years, the appropriation has not. In 2009, as you know, the governor made an unallotment of $20 million to the system for the remainder of the current biennium. That $20 million represents about a 2.9% reduction to this fiscal year state appropriation, but since it was all taken in the last 6 months of the year, the reduction amounts to nearly 6% for the remaining period. We're attempting to make the necessary reductions in a way that best serves students and preserves our partnership as economic development and community and regional development service across the state. Decisions about spending cuts on existing campuses are being made at the local level by our 32 presidents. The chancellor has asked the presidents to carefully scrutinize all hiring, travel, and other spending decisions, as he has also directed in the Office of the Chancellor. And so the Office of the Chancellor budget is undergoing a similar reduction and examination. Examples of some of the steps being taken include reducing the number of course sections, leaving positions vacant, restructuring staff assignments to delay hiring additional staff, pulling back on equipment and repair and replacement budgets, investing in energy conservation measures, examining possible postponement of new programs, postponing small construction and remodeling projects, and reducing travel through greater use of conference calls and other technology. In the short term, our options are very limited. Our bargaining contracts are in place, the class schedules are in place, and tuition has been set. The deadline for notifying faculty of layoffs for fiscal 2009 and 2010 has already passed. The timing for us then creates a dilemma. History shows that demand for higher education goes up as the economy goes down, and we're seeing that performance all across our campuses. I was just with all of our CFOs this morning, and I'm getting reports of enrollment increases of 12% and 13% and 15% across the state. And so history is proving itself out as well again this year. This fall, our system enrolled almost 3% more students than the previous fall, and we'll have spring numbers for you probably in a month. This puts pressure on the system to stretch resources to serve more students. At the same time, you may recall that our base funding was cut during the 2008 session by a net of $6.8 million, which together with the unallotment is a reduction of about $27 million for this fiscal year. As Trustee Ramirez mentioned, we will follow three principles as we approach the 2010-2011 challenge. First, we will look at all ways that we have to improve or at least protect the services we provide to our students. We'll take into account how we serve our community and the relationships we have in economic development and community partnerships. And as the chancellor mentioned, I believe we'll take a multi-year approach to this because we recognize that we have an obligation to keep our eye always on the future and strive to make decisions today that will strengthen our position in the future and leave us best able to do our mission as the state recovers. But I feel that I must tell you that a cut of 10.7%, which the governor recommended, would have consequences for our students and the communities that we serve. The mission of this public system of higher education is to provide access to higher education opportunities to all citizens of Minnesota. Among the 390,000 students that we serve each year are traditional age college students, dislocated workers, veterans, new immigrants, and groups traditionally underrepresented in higher education. Students from low-income families, first-generation college goers, students of color, and students for whom English is not their first language. It is worth noting that for fiscal 2009, students from Greater Minnesota made up 66% of our enrollment, and we programmed 70% of the money to outstate Minnesota. That is a strong part of our service. Despite these challenges, we're committed to driving innovation among our colleges and universities and strengthening partnerships and collaborations to increase our productivity. We simply must do these things to better serve all the students we serve today. But as you will note, with an 11% reduction, we will see access and opportunity curtailed. We will be looking at layoffs, program closures, enrollment caps, reducing course offerings, and other methods. Ann Winnia, president of North Hennepin Community College, and Richard Davenport, president of Minnesota State University Mankato, are here to talk a little bit with you about how they're approaching their budget planning, and I would invite them to the microphone.
Okay, if we could hold our questions. So, you know, bringing up the, you know, the already the pressures that you've seen, Ms. King, on the system and enrollment, that I do, and I see that former Representative Joe Opax is here in the audience, and Joe and I didn't always think on the same level, but I just do want to say publicly, Joe, to you that I want to thank you for your consideration and creativity when you announced your plan to let unemployed workers fill the seats that weren't filled in work at your school. I think it was creative, and who are you pointing at? Okay, and I want to commend both of you for that, because that's the kind of creativity I think we have to have. If you've got the seats there and they're sitting empty and you've got unemployed workers that can... And you limited it to a couple of courses or a couple... How many credits, Joe?
Do you want me to speak from here?
You can go ahead. This is pretty informal right now. I hope I'm not embarrassing you, but then again, I hope I am. So anyway, yeah...
We
Good, and there's some good examples for us. So welcome both of you to the committee. Nice to see you, Representative Winnia.
Thank you. Mr. Thank President. You, Chairman Rossavina, and members of the committee. I appreciate this opportunity to be here with you today. And for the record, I'm Ann Winnia, President of North Hennepin Community College. North Hennepin is located in the Northwest Metro area. We serve over 10,000 students, and a large proportion of our students are, or in some cases were, working adults. We have a very diverse student body and serve that mix of students that Vice Chancellor King described in her remarks. At the two-year college level, I think it's safe to say that virtually all the colleges focus their resources on educating students. We do not have a research mission. Our mission is to work with students. And as we begin to devise a plan for dealing with the budget challenges let me first lay out the process. Our campuses employ a consultative process. It may vary a little bit from campus to campus, but that is the expectation. At our campus, we ask each of our bargaining units, as well as our student senate, to identify who they would like to serve on a special budget task force that would examine our current expenditures, talk about opportunities for savings, and participate in the identification of the path that we will ultimately proceed upon. The choices are not going to be easy ones, and I appreciate the fact that we've had so many people from all of our bargaining units who are willing to serve. As we have dealt with the challenges before us, the immediate one that we dealt with earlier this year was the unallotment. And that required a very quick response in order to simply capture savings this year. And we dealt with that one by first canceling a building improvement remodeling project that we had planned for this, this spring that would have added some usable space. We canceled the purchase of an automobile for our security department. And we directed all of our deans and directors to review their non-personnel budgets and identify 10% cuts that they would be able to make. In most cases, it's by deferring purchases of supplies or equipment. And we utilize the tools that Vice Chancellor King talked about of not absolutely freezing all travel or all hiring, but subjecting all requests to strict scrutiny and justification. The challenge before us, as presented by the proposed governor's budget, is a much more substantial one. And I would first need to share with you that we've already done a considerable amount prior to this year of reallocation within our budget. We every year have to take a look at, as we see new requests, to identify things that we will get rid of. And so I would just share with you off the top that some of the things that are of great concern to me is that when we look at additions to our budget within the last 5 or 6 years that have been financed through reallocation, not through any new money that we have received from the state, it includes things like the creation of a security department. It is perhaps hard to believe, but 10 years ago, my campus did not have a security department. The security department consisted of a dean of liberal arts who used to occasionally patrol the parking lot. I think you will agree with me that in today's climate of concerns about school violence, that is not an acceptable level of security department. We are a campus that operates 7 days a week, from 7 in the morning until 11 at night. We now have a security department of 5 people to provide an on-site presence during those times. Another improvement that we made, again through reallocation, was the creation of a veterans center 2 years ago. This is to serve the returning veterans from Iraq and Afghanistan, and we did not receive any state funding for this, but we simply cut money from elsewhere in the budget to enable us to both construct and hire an individual who would serve as a counselor, advisor, etc., for this group of Minnesotans that I think all of us have identified as worthy of our attention. And the third indication that I would give you of the changes was the addition of a position for occupational health and safety, and someone with specific responsibility for oversight of hazardous waste. At a college that has a large science department, as well as a large building and grounds department, we have some significant responsibilities with regard to disposal of hazardous waste and the production of and the preservation of employee safety. This has been a very important position to us. And again, it's one of those things that when I look at our total array of the budget, I say, I don't know how we would do without it, but those are the kinds of things that we have already done without any additional money. but this is the reallocations, and so they are, of course, at risk. Some of the other areas of concern have to do with the classic two methods, of course, in higher education for dealing with budget shortfalls. If you have very few places to go other than personnel and your building. And we are very reluctant to embark upon either of those. We've experienced 9% enrollment growth this year without additional staff. But we feel we are being more productive than ever. And the prospect of hiring freezes is difficult at a time when we have many faculty who are retiring. Nevertheless, I will tell you that we are reconsidering some decisions that we made earlier this year to fill some positions that have been created by the retirement of faculty. We are also reluctant to simply stop maintaining our state building, feeling that that is an irresponsible course to take for the state asset, but recognize that at a time when there is simply no money, that that is oftentimes the easiest course to take. The final area that I would mention to you that is of concern is that at a two-year college, we serve many, many students who are new to higher education. No one in their family has ever attended college. And we find that for them to be successful, to actually be retained and to graduate, that they oftentimes need an additional supporting services in the way of tutors, in the math center or the writing center. They need extra support oftentimes in the library. And we find that by providing those kinds of support, we are able to improve the performance of these students and their retention. That, of course, is an area that is vulnerable because it is not funded directly by any tuition, but it is an area that I think at a time when our mission is to be accessible and to serve all Minnesotans and to enable those groups of people who have not had access to education to do so successfully, that would be a very tragic place to start making reductions. Thank you, and I'll be glad to answer that.
And we'll hold. All right, well, go ahead.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members. I am Richard Davenport, president of Minnesota State University in Mankato, and I appreciate the opportunity to visit with you this afternoon, representing the 7 university campuses within this system. And I'd like to share with you how we're going about preparing for the reductions that we know will come. First of all, I want to just say the universities are prepared to do our part. Just as Ann has indicated, the two-year colleges are doing the same. But we want to do it in a way that best serves the students and the state as well. Mr. Chair and members, I guess I'm here to tell you and let you know firsthand that I think the magnitude of these cuts are going to have a devastating and a long-lasting effect on higher education in Minnesota. We all fear a very significant decline in quality and in excellence due to the limited resources. I think that's almost a given, and we're trying to protect ourselves against that. We're concerned mostly about opportunities for access because we believe that they will be severely limited. And however, I'll assure you that all the presidents, 2- and 4-year presidents alike, are attempting to meet the needs of the 2-year college student as well as the baccalaureate and graduate student. Let me also mention that, Vice Chancellor King and President Winia, we're also going through many of the same kinds of discussions and eliminations and looking at reduction strategies that we can employ in the year ahead. And in terms of out-of-state travel, it's the first time that I've reviewed every single travel request at the institution, and that's important because I think it sends a very strong message how important it is that we save travel dollars. We're developing a much larger pool of potential reductions in anticipation that the economy may worsen, that we may have a more severe problem than what we currently have on the scene. And so we're preparing, and I believe all the colleges and universities are taking that tack. Likewise, leaving vacant positions open at this point unless they're absolutely essential. We are preparing for layoffs, as you might imagine. And at Minnesota State University Mankato, we've already eliminated 50 programs in the last few years as we've had to size down our budget. And we're looking to eliminate other programs and to downsize and to merge, and then to take the resources that we save from those programs and to reinvest in other high workforce market need areas. We'll be doing that with full cooperation of our faculty and our staff. Placing new programs on hold is absolutely essential at this time, but we're taking other steps. We are offering more online classes, such as all the other 31 colleges and universities, and that's important. I hope you understand there are so darn many students that can't come to the campus. If you're in greater Minnesota, there aren't very many opportunities to attend a university unless you're willing to commute. And so online learning for greater Minnesota is very important to reach the students. We're also replacing small size classes where we have a student faculty ratio perhaps of 23-24 to 1, which is a standard nationally, an ideal student faculty ratio depending on the kind of class. We're replacing them with large lecture classes. And on our campus, we don't have a lot of large lecture classrooms. And so recently, we started offering our large lecture classes, many of them, in the local cinema, which is about a half a block away. And they have several auditoriums there where we can offer classes. Students don't seem to mind that, and the chairs are a little more comfortable. Anyway, we're planning on reducing funds in just about every category that you might imagine. And as a university, we do have a research mission, as well as educating at the baccalaureate level. And already are earmarking research funds, graduate assistantships, and work study opportunities that are vital to our students in order for them to afford undergraduate and graduate education. And I have to say that the kind of reductions that I'm sharing with you today that we're talking about, it's done in a very transparent way. We're very open on the campus. We do involve the faculty, the staff, and the students. We do that in a variety of ways. We put all of the proposed reductions online. It's very transparent where anybody can look and see what are the reductions that are being presented as possibilities. We have, I hold town hall meetings where this is a one time when I get a great attendance to talk about the budget picture. We have open forums and, of course, regular newsletters to keep everybody involved. Naturally, we have the normal meet and confer process where we meet with all the bargaining groups and get their input as we move forward. We have on our campus something we developed called a budget calculator. So anybody, any faculty, staff, or student can go online and they can plug in all the different factors that might impact our overall budget and be watching the news and see what's happening up here and then factor that into the impact that it would have on our campus itself. I just also want to emphasize that we continue, all the universities and colleges, to be supportive of the board's goals. And the established dashboard measures of accountability are heavily embraced by the president, and we'll work diligently to make sure that we accomplish those goals. And we clearly understand the dynamics of the budget situation that is facing the legislature, governor, and the people of Minnesota. And there are no easy answers, but I do want to tell you that we want to maintain the Board of Trustees' goal of accessibility and affordability, and we want to do what is necessary in order to make those opportunities available to our students. But clearly, it's going to be extremely difficult to accomplish that. And it's going to be difficult to maintain the quality that the Minnesota State College University system is known for. with the reduced resources. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. President. Members, questions of the Chancellor, or Mr. Vernier, or Ms. King, or either of the Presidents. Ms. King, you have more to...
I do, Mr. Chair.
Yeah,
that's
all
right. When
that's
the
fine.
Committee is prepared, I've got a few more remarks to make, and then the Chancellor will come back and have a closing comment.
Okay, and members, your questions can be overall, so I mean, if you've got questions with Minsky besides the budget, go ahead and ask them. Well, I'll get to you, Representative Detmer, after Ms. King finishes up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The Presidents have talked about the tools they may use to face the budget cuts, but these tools come with limitations. For example, as I mentioned earlier, the deadline for notification for faculty layoffs for 2010 has passed. The earliest we could impose layoffs would be for fiscal 2011. Program closures likewise can't be accomplished overnight. Under accreditation requirements, institutions must give their students options to complete this program in a reasonable time. Labor contracts are in place, and we're already at the bargaining table for fiscal 2010-11. Think about what large cuts would mean for that process. Another unintended consequence of deep cuts is the impact on the accreditation of our institutions. The Higher Learning Commission has requirements about administrative capacity in areas such as financial aid and the business office. The staffing in these areas at some of our smaller colleges and universities is already very close to being out of compliance. We would likely close a school that couldn't get accredited, since if a college or university loses its accreditation, the students lose access to financial aid. The following comments are intended to provide you with a perspective on the scale of the governor's recommendation. We were asked earlier by the management and budget department to prepare this kind of a response, and I would just like to pass it on with you today. Each of the methods that I'll list will be sufficient of itself to reduce expenses to the recommended target from the governor, but we wouldn't certainly do only one of them. So I don't want you to think that we would do only one of them or that we would do all of them in their entirety. These comments don't represent the actions that we would take, nor should we view them as exclusive of one another. It's probable that we would apply a combination of all or most of the following tools should we be required to absorb such a significant reduction, but they do illustrate the magnitude of what we are facing. In order to balance the budget as recommended by the governor without making any other adjustments, it would require staff reductions of about 1,000 FTE, more than 15% of total staff. It would call for faculty reductions of more than 850 full-time equivalent faculty positions, or about a 10% reduction in total faculty FTE. The impact on course sections, registrations, and enrollments would be a reduction of about 8,800 sections, reduction of about 150,000 credit enrollments, or a decrease in student full-year equivalent enrollment of more than 14,000. Or we could increase tuition by 11% if we used just tuition and made no other changes. The average annual impact for a resident undergraduate full-time equivalent student would be about $480 over the current levels. Or finally, one other option just to scale this for you is that it's the equivalent of closing one of our largest universities and one of the largest colleges, or closing at least 10 of the smaller colleges in order to capture this kind of money. I would like to say one final word about tuition. In 2003, we solved most of the reduction with a tuition increase, and today the tuition at our community and technical colleges is second highest in the nation. Tuition at our state universities ranks 18th in the nation. Our Board of Trustees is committed to access and opportunity and has made a commitment that we will not go to tuition to solve this action, as we did in the earlier event. As we look at potential reductions, we will certainly look carefully at administrative expenses, but you should know that we already rank 46th out of 50 states in our spending on administrative activities on a per-student basis. Our administrative expenses, both on the campuses and in the Office of the Chancellor, are 19% below the national average for similar systems and institutions, and our overall spending on a per-student basis is 4% below the national average. There is no way that students are not going to be affected by a cut of 10%. Whether it's higher tuition, enrollment caps, fewer course offerings, or reduce student services, our students will feel an impact. Now, understand that we will do everything else we can before we go to any of those impacts, whether it's more partnerships, more collaborations, working to improve our productivity, working to identify ways to leverage online education in a way that improves student benefits, but we will have student impacts when it's all said and done. I'd like, if I might, Mr. Chair, to turn to the Chancellor, and he'll close us.
Mr. Chair, because of the circumstances that we're facing here in Minnesota, and the committee members, I would like to make just one last point, and that is the important role the University of Minnesota and we play in educating and retraining Minnesota's workforce during this economic recovery. Collectively, we will be the ones that help dislocated workers get back on their feet, retrain for new jobs. We can help newly unemployed residents retrain for new jobs. I think we play an important role and we're needed more than ever. And, you know, the investment in the most important resource that we have in Minnesota are the people of Minnesota. And the investment in the higher education is an investment in that most important resource. Mr. Chairman, this concludes our presentation. We stand ready for questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a couple of questions. One is, I think back to the President. President Winia and Davenport each talked a little bit about layoffs, but you didn't specifically give a number of potential layoffs that you're expecting or might be expecting this year or next year. And I'm just wondering if you have somewhat of an idea what you'd be looking at.
Jeff, could you pull another comfortable chair up here by Representative Mahoney and move it up towards the table so that your answer can stay up there?
Chairman Rossavino.
Thank you.
And Representative. You heard the overall numbers from Vice Chancellor King, and you know, if I simply extrapolate from that, then in order to deal with it at my college, we would probably be talking about faculty cuts of 15 or staff cuts of closer to 25. I'll be real honest, I'm not eager to do layoffs, and we're not putting that number out at this point because we're looking for other ways. That's the last place we want to go.
President Davenport?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Poppe. At Minnesota State University, we've calculated that our percentage of reduction is 14.2% of our overall operating budget, and that equates to roughly $8 million that we need to shave from our budget. We will be looking at personnel. We are looking at personnel. Certainly, adjunct positions are typically the first to go, and we're talking about adjunct faculty, which is unfortunate because they're the least expensive positions that deliver a significant amount of our curriculum. And so the number of adjunct positions that we typically hire every year ranges in the 60s to 70s, and those would be the positions that would go first. And then, of course, because of the bargaining contracts, we go up the seniority roster. Staff positions, obviously, are on the chopping block as well.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A follow-up, I guess. I'm a faculty member at a local community college in southern Minnesota. We've already had, at a minimum, 10 people laid off that are going to be in the next 30 to 60 to 90 days. I understand that there's a great budget deficit and that there's going to be a need to impact campuses, but I'm also going to be very pointed that I'd like to know what actually MinSCU and the central office will be doing, because when you're best serving students, you're doing that at a local campus and college. You're not necessarily doing that at a state central office. So I'd like to know if there's a ratio of layoff as we look at the local campuses that will impact each and every one of us throughout the state, if there's going to be a ratio to what's going to be happening in the state central office.
Mr. Chair, Representative Poppe, we agree with you, and we've been very, very careful to be aggressively looking at all the central accounts before we translate these results to the campuses, because we agree with your view. The central office spends about 3% of the total state appropriation. The campuses spend 97%. So that's the first sort of observation I would make. The way we approach budgeting, it wouldn't be our practice to tell the president that we know best how to manage their budget reduction decisions. You might see layoff differences from one campus to the next because of program differences, because of student differences, because of enrollment differences. So it wouldn't be our practice to try to dictate that from St. Paul. But we are very committed, excuse me, I'm choking on something. We are very committed to making sure that the central office is the first line of response to this so that we can preserve as much resource as possible for the campuses. The only other thing I would say is that in the central accounts, we also have all of the resources that support our technology program, as well as several other services that are delivered for the campuses on behalf of the campuses instead of the campuses having to do it. So there's sort of a blend there between just straight policy staff and service staff. I have staff in the finance department that do loan collection for all of the campuses, so they don't have to hire loan collectors 32 times. We have staff in the central office that do payroll and HR transactions on behalf of all the campuses, so the campuses don't have to do them 32 times. That's one of the reasons why we're at the 46th, on average, our administrative spending is 46th in the country. It's because we've used the scale of the system and technology to really try to leverage every opportunity. So we agree with you, and we'll be very attentive to that, and we'll report as we go on how we're approaching it.
Representative. Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And this question probably deals with the total policy, not necessarily a fiscal question, but we have 32 institutions. With the way the economic situation, you might have people transferring from one institution to another based on seniority. Now, is your seniority system based on a total MSQ system, or is it just individual institution? And are these transfers, can these be done electronically, where people from one institution could be transferred to another institution without having to go through all the paperwork and filling out applications? They all have IDs, numbers in the MSQ system. Can it be done, or do they have to go from one institution to another and do all the paperwork again?
And the question, sir, is employees. And Bill Cheat is our chief human resources officer. Bill?
Yeah. My name is Bill Cheat. I'm the vice chancellor for human resources for the system. The system is slightly different for each of our collective bargaining units. Some of them do have statewide claiming rights, so that if they're laid off at one institution, they can claim a vacancy at another institution. We maintain those that central process in the office of the chancellor, notifying people who've received layoff notices of the jobs that are available, and then they contact the institution. Typically, no, they don't have to fill out a new application and that sort of thing. It really circumvents our normal job filling procedures. Other bargaining units, their bumping rights or claiming rights are limited to the institution at which they're employed, but then they also do have access to filling vacancies that might be filled at another institution.
Mr. Chairman, just a follow-up. So which group, bargaining group, does not have to go through the paperwork of filling out new applications?
Well, the faculty at the two-year institutions have statewide claiming rights to jobs. At the faculty at the four-year universities, they don't have claiming rights to a job at another state university. They do get preferential consideration if they wish to apply for a job like that.
Chair, and just to clarify, then they're in the system. They're in the computer system, so there's no paperwork for them to do the transfer?
typically there is not much paperwork. They do have to send a letter indicating that they want to claim a position. They may be asked to provide some information about how their background fits the job that they want to claim, but not in terms of the traditional job application where you fill out all of that information that we already have on file for them, such as what their degrees are and so forth.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Norton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just go back for a minute to the, the administration. Some of the faculty at the college that I represent have told me they think that probably, and I'm not talking the central office, I'm talking about the local campus, that maybe the administrative percentage is a little high. And I'm wondering if that's being looked at. And the other part of the question would be, are they under the same contract language where notice needs to be given, or are they more or less employed at will?
Mr. Chair, Representative Nernis, as to the ratio of administrative staff on campus to faculty, is your first question. That is looked at every year and managed through our allocation process and measured very carefully, and you get a report from us every year that shows that our total spending on education in the campuses is about 65%. So we work very hard to hold the instruction and academic support part of the budget at or above 65%, as is required in statute. I think statute says they want it to improve every year. So that's one way we do it. It's also the case that there's tremendous cultural pressure on campuses to, when cutting budgets, to cut everywhere but the classroom. And we share that value. Our object is to deliver as much instructional service as possible, and so that means we try to keep the dollars in the classroom. But it's also the case that the presidents hear from me and from my administrative colleagues that we expect the administrative structure to stay intact. We expect financial statements to get done. We expect legal compliance to be in place. So there's tension there between the administrative and the academic decision-making, and presidents work it out in a way that they know they have to talk to the chancellor about in the end.
Chancellor McCormick, do you want to weigh in?
Yeah, Mr. Chair and Representative Norton, the presidents are evaluated each year. They're employees of the board. My responsibility is to evaluate them in terms of how they're doing, and that's quite an extensive review. In fact, the month of July is just about back-to-back trying to get those done. At that point, I have my staff prepare very detailed numbers and so on. So if we see something that's out of line or raise a question, it would be talked about at that time, and we would try to, in a counseling way, coaching way, to say, you look out of line, why, what can we do about that? I also think Laura should tell the committee for a little bit, because I think this is an innovation. Laura, we're trying to get combinations of institutions to do the back office work more efficiently together. And I think that's an innovation that you and Bill have been pushing, and I think the committee ought to hear about that.
Certainly.
Because the little colleges, if you do everything there, it's much more expensive. Just like in our central office, we have all the legal people there, 5 lawyers, I guess, instead of 32 lawyers across the system. But talk about the back office efforts to save money that are underway.
I'd be happy to, Mr. Chair. And I think the chairman should take some credit for this, because it's made possible through the technology money that this committee provided for us over the last biennium. We needed to make several...
It'd be a shame to cut it.
It'd be a shame to cut it. I agree, Mr. Chair. We made several very large investments in technologies in this past biennium, principally which were necessary to make this possible. We're working to build a different kind of team that would provide payroll, accounts receivable, accounts payable, purchasing, some cash management, some general accounting services support, on sort of a fee-for-service basis to multiple colleges and colleges primarily. I don't think we have any universities in the discussion, because they're large enough to have their own business office sort of stood up. This will enable us to do a couple of things. it would take tremendous pressure off the presidents of the smaller colleges who simply can't staff the requirements for their administrative support. It would improve the quality of the services that they get, the reliability and the accuracy of the information they get, and it would get done at a lower cost. It's possible because of the technology investment of the last couple of years. We had some very technical problems that we couldn't get past until we made some changes in the technology, and we're on the verge now of having those changes made, and it will make it possible for us to take 4 or 5 or 6 or 8 business and HR offices off campus into a sort of a virtual service center model, and we're very excited about it.
Mr. Chair,
Representative,
could I follow up? One more question, if I can, and it'll be a brief answer.
Good.
Okay.
All right. Go ahead.
This would be to the Chancellor or to Ms. King-Kligas. Earlier in the testimony, you were talking about enrollments going up, projected enrollments, actual whatever. Have you taken into consideration the increase in tuition that's going to be taken in as you project the necessary cuts that you need to make?
Ms. King, are your figures based on anticipated tuition revenue increase?
Mr. Chair, I would have noticed that the remarks I made toward the end about what would happen to our enrollment with the reduction we're talking about, those were standalone remarks. So I didn't assume any tuition increase in that result. We have started to see enrollment soften as tuition has gone up. We know that there's a relationship.
Okay, you may have misunderstood. I was asking about not the tuition increase, but the enrollment increase, yes, which would bring in more tuition dollars.
Yes,
I did misunderstand.
No, there was nothing in my remarks that tried to guess how much tuition revenue we would have that's not already in the forecast. But you're right, that's out there occurring at some level. We won't know until all the pieces stop moving, but that is an upside for the president.
Okay, sorry, Mr. Chair, but an upside for only a little while. If you can think of the airline model, if we have vacant seats and we can fill them, there's no more cost. But the minute you need to run another airplane for a few people, then you get into the cost, half coming from tuition, half from the state. So I think we'll fill the seats more, but there'll be a point when we can't offer them in court.
Right.
Okay. Thanks.
Representative Carlson.
Mr. Chairman, I think that last point was a good one, because we've talked about that before, some margin, and that eventually also open additional sections. But I did have a couple of questions, Mr. Chairman. The first one, the handout that you had here on tuition, I think is helpful. It shows the trend. But my recent discussions in recent years on the costs have really centered on the cost of attendance, which is quite a different issue, and I don't know if you have that available now, but I would request that perhaps that information be provided. I just had a couple of conversations with the Fitzen writer at the University of Minnesota on that very point. Cost of attendance versus tuition is quite a different number.
Mm-hmm.
And so you could provide at least to me at some point what you're talking about there.
Mr. Chair, if I might, as Representative Carlson, I presume that you'd like that to reflect netting out of financial aid, grossing up any fees.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I was asking that question relative to the total number of the costs. I understand that financial aid offsets some of that, but I would be interested, at least as you've done with, I don't think you've netted out financial aid. So what would be a comparable number to your charge here relative to tuition? And that would give us another trend. And I'm just interested.
Absolutely. In part. Got it.
Commissioner, go ahead.
And then, so that's just a request for the information, but I do have a question, and maybe this could best be answered by either of the two presidents or both, President Winia or President Davenport. I've also, over time, been quite interested in what I used to call timely completion. And related to that, when we've had discussions previously about budget cuts, there has been concern that as sections are closed and so on, that will have an impact on the ability of students to finish a four-year degree in 4 years, or in the case of President Winia's college the ability to finish a undergraduate degree in 2 years. And if you could share with the committee what your thoughts are there as you reduce the number of sections, should that happen, and the impact on students being able to get done.
Mr. Chair, Representative Call. So let me just say that it's common knowledge in the higher ed circles that when we phase out a program that we feel obligated to see that all the courses are offered in order for the student to complete that program. And sometimes that extends into 3 years beyond the decision when it's made. Minnesota State University Mankato had an interior design program 4 years ago, 250 students in that program. We decided to phase that program out and drop it. And just this year now, the final students will be moving through. So there is an obligation. There isn't an instant return on the revenue because you are phasing it out. But it is an ethical obligation when we admit those students in the program to make sure that they get through.
Representative Carlson, we're actually struggling with that question right now because we're looking at our schedule for next year and trying to think about ways that we might save some money. And there are a number of programs that we have, for example, in our business program, where we will offer a class, both a day section and a night section, because our campus is virtually as chilled in the evening as it is during the day. And neither one of those sections is going to fill the capacity. And so we're struggling and thinking about, well, should we offer the day section one semester and the night section another semester? And to do that is going to limit opportunities for students because our students don't come in and just finish on a nice little fourth semester pattern. They finish their education over 8 years. And they just get the classes in as they can. And so we're wrestling with what is going to be the impact on students, but we really don't see that we're going to have a lot of opportunities if we're going to need to increase the number of students in each section than to simply offer them less frequently.
Sure, just a quick follow-up.
President Carl.
President Davenport said, I understand what you're saying about closure and meeting the needs of friends. Another part of that question, however, would be, and what comes to mind when all the state universities, I know a few years ago at least, was advertising and recruiting. If you attended Winona State, they would guarantee you that you'd be able to complete a degree in 4 years. And so that would also be a part of that question as well. I guess you answered it phase out, which was, if you could comment on the second part.
That is a good question, and it's important in responding to that to understand that we communicate with the students that are in the program. We cut off enrollment on a specified date so no other new students can get into the program. And then with each student, we give them a roadmap in regards to when the courses are going to be offered over the next 3 or 4 years and give them the date in which that program will be discontinued. So they're advised very, very closely in order to complete the program of studies. We know that it's expensive to do that, but it's also an obligation that we feel.
Thank you.
Okay. Before we go further, I want to make sure that we take care of the minutes. So, Representative Slocum, have you reviewed the minutes, and would you make a motion to approve them?
Mr. Chair, I've reviewed them thoroughly, and I move we approve the minutes.
Okay. Are there any corrections or questions about the minutes? All those in favor of approving the minutes, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Okay, the minutes are approved. Okay, I have a question from Representative Downey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and let me just preface my remarks by giving my thanks and commendations to Minskew. I actually believe that your system is perhaps the key to our future economy, given the university's extended research mission, and recognize fully the importance, and I commend you, too, in terms of the way you've managed your system and responded to the board's challenges in your controls on tuition. So with that, I have a couple questions about maybe kind of from a macro perspective. Do you have an ability to look at excess capacity in a time like this, kind of system-wide? We've talked a lot about what you would do at your respective institutions. How do you manage that capacity? And a related question, you know, kind of strategically, were you on the front end of building out capacity, and do you have excess capacity in the system as a whole, or were you kind of at a point where capacity was maxed out? I'd be curious to where you see yourself at strategically.
Ms. King.
Mr. Chair, Representative Downey, we have a lot of information about what our capacity is. And as you see our capital budget come forward, you will see a very detailed information on a per-building basis about our capacity and our utilization. And we've used that information very aggressively in our capital budget planning process. If you talk to outstate presidents, you'll find that we haven't built, but for the state universities and new science buildings, we haven't built essentially a new square foot in 10 years in outstate Minnesota. You've helped us do a lot of renovation and rehab and sort of meats and potatoes kind of project work, but we have not added square footage. We've been working, in fact, to try to take square footage out. So on a physical standpoint, we have a lot of information about our capacity and our utilization, and we hook that up with the academic planning so that as capital planning is done, it's done in the name of the academic program, and we look for ways to provide the academic program inside the existing walls by either recycling large rooms into small rooms or small rooms into large rooms or whatever it takes. On the academic program planning standpoint, we also have a lot of information about who's offering what programs and what their enrollments are, and have a process that reviews programs before they're added in order to make a judgment as to whether there's adequate demand to absorb another program being added anywhere in the state. So we work that pretty aggressively. One of the things that was interesting to me in the governor's remarks was the comment he made about duplication and his hope that we would eliminate duplication. And I would just share with you, in the past 2 years, we have introduced 352 new programs, redesigned 563 programs, and closed or suspended 362 programs. So you see almost 1,000 programs have been picked up and looked at and examined. They've been altered to respond to business and industry requirements or labor market changes, or they've been closed because there wasn't sufficient demand. So we think we're pretty responsive to both the duplication and the program requirements. The chancellor likes to say that one of the things that really impressed him when he got to Minnesota was how aggressive the community and technical colleges are around this program management issue. They will open and close programs in the course of 2 years if the demand comes up and goes down.
One thing also, Mr. Chair, and thank you for your comments about our fiscal management. Mr. Scott Fisk takes a heavy role in that along with the rest of the board. One thing I learned, that you're going to do visitations with the Capital Budget Committee, always visits. And one of the things that I had to learn is that you've got to look at technical space differently than you look at community college or university space. Because you can have quite a large building or facility, 12-foot ceilings, for diesel mechanics, and you might have three or four big diesel trucks or tractors in there with a small group of students, but you can't schedule other things in there. So you have a huge building or a huge facility that's tied up with a very special technical program. So I think we had to learn, as we looked at these things, that technical schools need to be looked at with a little different eye than the traditional teaching that we usually think is the case. We and just one more point, the office and the president, and I think your associates that deal with the capital budget, we really work hard to present to you for consideration a capital budget that is looking at all these things. We are not going to renovate a building if we don't need it. We're not going to build one if we don't need it. And we do always in the capital budgets have some things in there for demolition. So we're really trying to stay on top. But we have to be vigilant because programs are changing. And we're really trying to address that. Now, I do need to say, on behalf of the campuses in the city that have grown very rapidly, Normandale, Century, and I could probably list some more, we have had a hard time catching up because they are growing so rapidly. So so we're usually behind on our numbers in terms of those programs.
Okay. Representative Hawes.
Thank you very much. I would like to go back to, I've heard negative comments also about the cost of central administrative costs, and I don't know if they were pertaining to the amount of money spent there or the rapid growth that they perceive. So you don't have to comment on that, but I think you should know that I think it's running deep at many of the campuses, and it's something maybe needs to be brought to light and examined and reviewed with your staff or with us. To, if it's not true, maybe we should have a different set of facts. I have some questions though on the collective bargaining units. Where we're at, are we in a 1 year or a 2 year bargaining unit? Has there been formal or informal discussions going on with the bargaining units for the potential freezing of salaries or fringe benefits versus job loss? And I just wanted to know what your comment is on the collective bargaining units and where you think that might be headed or not headed.
Yes, thank you, Chair, Representative Hawks. We have contracts that are in place until June 30th. So it is the appropriate time to begin the bargaining and the discussion with our bargaining units. And under Bill Cheetah's leadership, we will be beginning those discussions, and I'm sure all of those things are on the table for discussion. But the way this works for new legislators is that the system bargains for two faculty groups and one administrative faculty group. The governor's team bargains for the MAIT and the AFME. But we do have the three units. Now, there is a lot of discussion between the governor's office people and our people about those activities. Bill, thank you for coming. Is there anything else you need to add?
Mr. Chair, I might just add that the process that the two presidents described, the consultation with their campuses that involves the various bargaining units, also occasionally leads to us engaging in memorandums of understanding if they want to alter some process in the collective bargaining agreement in order to save jobs or save money through some other way. So both of those things that's going on locally through the budget process, and then we'll be entering the negotiations process shortly.
And Mr. Chair, Mr. Hawes, we need to find a way to communicate on the central office operation. We have about 20,000 employees. We have about 400 that would be viewed as central office. That includes the president. And I know you need more later, but and of those 400, perhaps 70 or 80 of them are out of campuses. But of the 400, less than half of them are sort of attorneys, finance people, and so on. And of that group, of the whole group, I think there's 174 MAITs and a number of AFME. But of the group, more than half of it is IT. And the IT is on behalf of institutions and the central office. And I know their presidents would testify that they get that it would cost them 2 to 3 times as much, the bigger places, to duplicate it, and the smaller places probably could not. But it's going to be looked at. Out of the first $20 million that we took, we cut $980,000 out of the central office as part of that. And the other part of the 200 that do everything else, about 70% of that our student services, and the president look at that from time to time, and we ask the question, are those worth having, or should we get out of them? So I would welcome, this has been a problem that I've heard about from the day that I arrived. I hope that we could present some facts, and I actually don't think the criticism's coming from our president, because they are part of it. So I really would like to get at some way, so Mr. Chair, I'd welcome a small committee or whatever to get to come look, examine, compare, because I'd like to get beyond that if we possibly could. Thank you for raising it.
Thank you, Chair. We'll recommend that. You have another
follow-up comment. If I implied it was coming from a top echelon presence, it is not.
No, I didn't.
But it's out there, and it's pretty consistent, and it's worth addressing, because you might as well, if they're doing it in some locality, you might as well face it with that. So, okay. Thank you.
Representative Obermiller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Chancellor, I had the pleasure of meeting with you and Egan. I wanted to say thanks for coming out and taking the time to meet with all the first-year members. I think we talked a little bit back then about online classes, and I was hoping you could give me some information, and maybe someone else has better input, but as to how, it seems to me there's kind of two ways to run your online program. You can have a class that's with live students in the classroom and tape it and use it online, or you can have a separate class where you're actually, you know, running an online curriculum. Are we doing, is the Minsky system doing both of those, and is there efficiencies in doing the former rather than the latter to save some money here?
Mr. Chair, thank you. I'm going to have Linda Baer, who's our senior officer of academics, that's sort of the creator of us moving in this direction with our presence, to say a few words. But we're growing rapidly, much more of that going on. It takes student services to back it up, and I think you asked a great question, Linda.
Mr. Chair and
it's Representative Obermuller,
thank you. I'm Linda Baer. I'm the Senior Vice Chancellor for the Minnesota State Colleges and Universities. The question about online education, let me clarify that you asked whether we create one program that then goes to all or multiple programs.
Well, Mr. Chair, it's a question of whether we're taking a class that already exists and we're turning that class that still has live students in it into an online program, or whether we're starting from scratch and creating a new online program.
Okay, Mr. Chair and Representative, we are doing both. We have on-site courses. We have online courses. The predominant mode that we're serving is hybrid, where part of what we're doing on-site has an online component. That means ready access to tutorials, opportunities to do simulations, work that helps a student when they're off-site do the work and not always on-site. So that's number one. Number two, we do have parallels where they're on-site and they're online and they're 100% online. And many students that don't have the capacity, they're full-time workers, they can't commute. In a hearing that we did in the Senate recently, we had a faculty member and two students, and the chair of the committee thanked them for coming down from Bemidji because the program was a Bemidji program in teacher education, and they all said, but we're not from there. One was from a small community, a rural community on the Iowa border, a person who was a laid-off worker in this program because he'd been laid off as a drug and alcohol counselor at a school district, and now is in special ed. So some of these are directly to people who are full-time workers that could not go to Bemidji or go to a campus, and rather, because of efficiencies or costs or convenience, do it online.
We have about 4 minutes left, and I have three questioners, so please be brief with your questions. Representative Poppy.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. As a follow-up to Representative Haas' comments regarding how to actually help us to see more about what Minsky does, I'd like to see a flow chart and job descriptions of all of the 400 people that you have at the Minsky Central Office to give us a better idea of who does what and who they report to and how that helps campuses. And if that's a possibility, I would request that.
Representative Briner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First of all, I'll have to say I have to come to St. Paul to learn what's happening in Mankato because I had no idea that we were teaching classes at the cinema. So I'll just have to take a walk over there and peek in and see how that's working out. To pursue the online discussion a little further, and I don't know who wants to take this question, but you know, the governor's proposal for 25% online learning has been advanced as a cost-saving measure, and we've heard varying points of view from the University of Minnesota about whether indeed online learning ought to be pursued as a cost-saving measure, what the strengths and weaknesses are of looking at it in that manner, and what the strengths and weaknesses are of the online model itself, what it has to offer and what its limits are. And I'd just like to hear some comment from the Minsky perspective on this.
Mr. Chair and Representative Reiner. The strengths and weaknesses of online education. One, sometimes I like to say we're somewhat at the infancy or the pioneering stage of what we do online. The very beginning of online probably was the best we knew was the lecture model, and so we scanned lecture notes and we sent them out over the internet, and that was called an online course. Today we're much different than that. And that's why so much of our programming is really hybrid, because we now know that simulations and tutorials and things about multiple language use even can be done online. And so the issue of what works is what works for students. It's not for everybody. It is about people who are more self-directed. It often works more for our adult learner because they know they've got to get in, learn a competency, or get a certificate or a degree and get out. And so it takes some discipline to be able to do that. Currently, it's not also for every faculty member to teach. And so we do have ways of saying, you're going to take this online course. Do you have the technology? Do you have the broadband connection? Do you have self-discipline to stick with it? Because you're not going to be going to a class every day where somebody's going to say, are you here? Did you do the homework? What's going on? So that's the piece about who is it for. The weaknesses still are being able to address the kind of technology that really empowers the learning. We know the very best learning that we can put together for students. We can customize it more online than we can sometimes in the classroom. But are we putting those tools to play right now? Are we putting them in play? It is not cheaper. It is more time intensive. Think about this. Students that are online, very often the most likely time they're using the online opportunities is 2 a.m. in the morning. If they run into a problem, how do we answer their questions? Well, we put a help desk together, a 24/7 help desk. Second, they expect faculty to respond rather quickly when they're online. They're doing instant messaging all the time. Why isn't that faculty member answering rather quickly? And so the intensity is that. The other is learning the technology, aligning to the right pedagogy. That means learning happens best with certain kinds of technologies, and then implementing them. The simulations that we put in play are very expensive, but they're improving the healthcare training that we do, not only for our own students, but for local, rural, particularly, healthcare providers that come and practice on our simulators to be better ready to really respond to crisis situations.
Thank you. Professor Welty.
Thank you. Thank you, Chairman Blythe. And this question is also about online, so I wanted to follow up with a couple other questions that were asked. When the university students came in, they expressed some concern that they are seeing colleagues of theirs not complete a course, or not even that, but just not complete the 4 years of the program. And so I'm wondering, as far as online classes, have you been, I know it's in infancy stages, but have you been keeping track of completion of course and then also completion of a program, and what are the trends that you're seeing right now? Is the level of non-completion higher in online than it is in the regular classroom?
And we're almost out of time. So.
Okay, I'll be very quick. We do have the numbers. I don't have them right in front of me. The completion rate of courses is a little lower for online right now. It is a little lower. I admit to that. The graduation for 100% online, I would have to get for you.
Okay. And next week, Tuesday, the committee will be with Minsky of Students and faculty discussing the budget and other issues. On Thursday, Susan Hegard of Office of Higher Education will walk through all the governor's higher ed budget recommendations. I also have a resolution here that the Chair Rukavina has on board. If you'd like to come and look at it or sign it, it has to do with memorializing the President and Congress to enact a new deal for new millennium for higher education to enable the state to rebuild public higher education and to increase access to higher education. Anyone move to adjourn?
So moved.
We are adjourned.